What we're going to look at next is a page of the San Francisco Chronicle from last week, which has an interesting juxtaposition within three columns of each other. Actually, within one column of each other, we have some eulogies that were spoken over the grave of Baruch Goldstein in Israel, lauding him for his massacre of the Arabs. It's some pretty strong stuff and some fairly ripe rhetoric. And then, just two columns over, we have Khalid Mohammed of the Nation of Islam making some statements about Jews, which I think perhaps even Goebbels would have found a little bit on the embarrassing side. Certainly déclassé. The juxtaposition of these two hate speeches, or series of hate speeches in the case of the eulogies for Baruch Goldstein, I think in many ways not only express some of the blood enmity that has worked itself out in the news in this past week. We've seen, of course, continued disturbances in the Middle East in response to the massacre of the Arabs in the mosque, and now a somewhat less bloody shooting in New York of some Hasidic Jews by a Lebanese national who's given a variety of different excuses as to why he did what he did. There have been reports hotly denied by the authorities of possible links between him and a drug trafficking ring, and also there was at least one ABC News report linking him with a terrorist group. Both have been denied by numerous authorities. But the polarization, the ideological hatred and ethnic hatred that is expressed in those two speeches, I think, beyond its significance for the past week's events, a week, by the way, in which we also saw a conviction in the case of the World Trade Center bombing, this past week we've seen a manifestation of the polarization of viewpoints, not only on the issue of the Middle East, but I think we're also seeing a viewpoint being expressed in the rhetoric of Khalid Mohammed, which is indicative of how groups which on their surface would not appear to have any reason to work with the forces of fascism wind up doing so. And this might seem a little bit long-winded or a little bit abstruse for some listeners, but what we're going to be looking at this evening is the ideological mystification that fascism has engaged in. We are also going to touch on fascism as it related to anti-colonial struggle in the World War II period. The Third Reich, for example, as well as Imperial Japan to a lesser extent, was able to utilize certain nationalist groups in nations or in territories that were colonies of other nations, largely Great Britain. The desire for independence from the British Empire was utilized to a certain extent by the Third Reich and also by Imperial Japan to create proxy armies and fifth columns in some of their opposing enemies' camps. We're going to be looking this evening at fascist ideological mystification and how one of the results of that is the affiliation of groups which, while not explicitly fascist, have found one aspect or another of the fascist dream bag to be, or ideological dream bag, I should say, to be sufficient to their cause under the circumstances. I guess one could term this part of the broadcast strange bedfellows, because we're going to be looking at some strange bedfellows, some fellows who've shared the same political bed, whom one might not expect to be doing something of that type. We're going to be taking a look, among other things, at the fascist Zionists. One of the things that is not often recognized about the history of Zionism is that it is a much more pluralistic political entity than has been generally recognized. There are democratically minded Zionist elements, leftist Zionist elements. There's also a very powerful reactionary element of Zionism, and the reactionary element of the Zionist movement has found its expression on the world stage, in particular in the Middle East, through such acts ranging from the invasion of Lebanon in 1982, a policy which was to a large extent a precipitate of the Israeli right, right on up through the recent massacre by Baruch Goldstein. We're going to be taking a look at the intersections of the political careers of Menachem Begin and also Yitzhak Shamir with the forces of fascism in World War II. And we're also going to take a look at a very odd political alliance between elements of the Zionist movement in Germany and elements of the Sicherheitsdienst, the SS intelligence service. After that, we're going to be taking a look at some of the stylistic and psychosocial affinities as perceived by black nationalist leader Marcus Garvey and Mussolini's fascisti in Italy. Now, when you hear the description of Garvey's movement, characterized by Garvey himself as being, quote, first fascists, one should not confuse this rhetorical use of the word, I think, referring more to the psychosocial aspects of fascist behavior rather than the corporatist ideology that was explicit in Mussolini's fascism. Rather, I think one can look on Garvey's assessments as referring to stylistic, rhetorical, and methodological similarities between the two movements. However, the separatist and militant aspects of Garvey's movement also led to a very, very strange alliance, one of these sets of strange bedfellows that we're going to be looking at this evening, namely an alliance and an affinity with, of all institutions, the Ku Klux Klan, specifically a Klan leader named E.S. Cox, worked briefly with Garvey, and we're going to be taking a look at that very, very odd alliance and some of the ideological mystification and some of the political manipulation which has spawned alliances like the Garvey affinity for Mussolini and also the KKK, explicitly expressed, by the way, by Marcus Garvey here. Again, not fascism in its purest sense, but rather in terms of a psychosocial approach to fascism, a methodological approach, or rather a methodological approach to social action, and also because of some tactical similarities in terms of racial separation theories, we're going to take a look at not only the Marcus Garvey, Ku Klux Klan, Mussolini affinity, but also historical relationships and political relationships between the Nation of Islam under Elijah Muhammad and the Ku Klux Klan elements and elements of the Texas Right, and such as the John Birch Society elements grouped around the Hunt-Murchison-Texas political axis. We're also going to be taking a look at a working relationship between the Nation of Islam and the American Nazi Party of George Lincoln Rockwell. We're then going to begin taking a look at some of the political forces that are behind some of the strange bedfellows that elements of the black nationalist movement has found tactically. By the way, in Radio Free America 13, we took a look at alliances between the Farrakhan organization, or we took a look at connecting links, operational links, between the Farrakhan organization and elements of the Aryan Nations. More about that later in the program. We're going to be taking a look this evening at the assessment by a Ku Klux Klan leader named Roy Frankhauser, also for a period of time a CIA contract agent, that the way in which Hitler used the Jews in Europe was very similar to the way he and other racists and white supremacists and fascists in America planned to use the blacks, and in fact how they were already doing that. As Frankhauser put it, Hitler had the Jews, we've got the niggers, and we're going to be taking a look at the strategic manipulation of the racial issue, and in particular their use of so-called black militants as recruiting tools. After that, we're going to be taking a look at the forces behind elements like Roy Frankhauser, George Lincoln Rockwell. We're going to touch on the George Lincoln Rockwell, Lee Harvey Oswald connection this evening, and also a fellow named Daniel Burroughs, another acquaintance of Oswald. Burroughs was involved in a very strange suicide at Frankhauser's home, a three-bullet suicide. We're going to take a look at some of the forces that underlie and are connected with the paramilitary right wing and domestic American fascists. Elements like the Minutemen, elements like the American Nazi Party or the States' Rights Party are often seen as a bunch of rednecks with NRA patches on their jackets, and in fact there's a whole lot more to it than that. Not only do elements of the paramilitary right have very significant financial backing from such forces as the Murchison Financial Empire and Hunt Financial Empire, but beyond that, they have operational links and functional relationships with elements of the National Securities Establishment as well as the FBI. Not that the FBI or intelligence agencies are, or any of our intelligence agencies are monolithic in this type of behavior, but the point that one should understand when one looks at the statements and behaviors of the Roy Frankhausers and the George Lincoln Rockwells of the world, and then notes the connections of elements like that with black nationalists ranging from Marcus Garvey all the way on up through Louis Farrakhan, is that it has produced a relationship which is ominously similar to that which the Zionist movement of Germany had during the period prior to the final solution to the Jewish problem. We're going to take a look also at elements of the paramilitary right, a Minuteman American Nazi Party milieu, and how that particular milieu intersects with elements that appear to have been involved with the assassination of President Kennedy. God willing, and the crick don't rise from a time standpoint. We're then going to take a look, first of all, at the death of Vincent Foster, one of the elements now looming large in the Whitewater scandal, which, despite its relatively low-stakes beginning, is now beginning to mushroom in terms of its media play. The actual forces involved in the Whitewatergate scandal are really quite trivial for the most part, but the handling of it has been less than deft so far. And it'll be interesting to see just how Bill Clinton is able to fare during the coming political storm. We're going to take a look at an article called from The Economist, called The Three Deaths of Vincent Foster. After that, we're going to take a look at an article sent in by a listener from the Wall Street Journal. This particular article has an interesting detail, not necessarily significant, although it could conceivably wind up in the trial of Aldrich Ames. Some of the ill-gotten gains that Aldrich Ames allegedly received from the Soviet Union are deposited in the Banca Nazionale del Lavoro. That Rome-based bank, of course, was deeply involved in the Iraqgate scandal. Mr. Ames was stationed where ran the Soviet operations branch of a CIA, the CIA station in Rome, for a three-year period. There is no information linking him with the BNL scandal, but it is within the realm of possibility, I suppose, that he may know something about it, having been in that position, and might have some very interesting things to say during his upcoming trial. Not necessarily during the trial, but he might drop a few things privately in that could perhaps affect the outcome of his judicial situation. We're then going to take a look at an article from the Daily Journal, this also sent in by a listener. The Daily Journal is a legal newspaper. This deals with an interesting alleged, an interesting development in the investigation into the Inslaw case, an alleged covert intelligence unit within the Justice Department using the OSI, allegedly are formed to track down Nazi war criminals. That's unit is, according to people providing information to the Inslaw company, involved in covert intelligence of various kinds and has even been implicated in aspects of the Inslaw case as well as the death of Danny Casolaro, according to people connected with the Inslaw case. We're going to take a look at some of the people involved in the Inslaw case and various aspects of its cover-up. William Barr, former Attorney General. D. Lowell Jensen, former Assistant Attorney General. We're also going to take a look at a fellow named Mark Richard, who was a Deputy Assistant Attorney General who was generally in charge with handling cases that were involved in some way the intelligence community. We're going to take a look at the connections between Mark Richard and the Inslaw case. Recall, we have looked at Mark Richard in the past in connection with his role, according to a number of observers, in the Waco situation, the Branch Davidian situation. He has also cropped up in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal, the Turple Wilson investigations, and others in recent years. We're then going to look at an interesting development with regard to the trial of the 11 Branch Davidians. The Florida weapons dealer, Henry McMahon, who has behaved in what I find to be a very intriguing fashion. With regard to the Branch Davidian situation, the defense in the recent trial of 11 members of the Branch Davidian cult wanted to call Mr. McMahon as a witness. They were unable to do that. We're going to touch on that as the next item up. We're going to close the discussion this evening, if we have time to get in all of this information, with an article which is significant, I think, because it represents a distinct trend in military research and development with regard to weaponry. Various so-called non-lethal weapons are being developed, which would permit military forces to neutralize in a non-lethal fashion, though not necessarily a non-damaging fashion, of various opponents, and it is being touted as a very good thing for military forces to use when they have to deal with civilian populations. I think that's a trend that we're likely to be seeing both abroad and at home. And we're going to conclude with a look at the use of infantry carried or shoulder carried laser weapons for use by infantry forces. They are touted as ideal riot control devices. Blinded by the Light will be the last article up on tonight's broadcast. So, that should fill people's intellectual plates, I think, and hopefully satisfy their intellectual appetites for this evening. One of the reasons why I stress continually the use of the archive programs, I can appreciate that some of the newer listeners might find some of the things that I talk about with Professor Stauffer to be a little bit incredible. I refer listeners to, among other broadcasts, Radio Free America program number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. To make a very long story very short, the Third Reich did not disappear as is commonly believed. I know that will seem like utter fantasy or madness on the part of the newer listener, but in fact, as Napoleon said, history is written by the victors, and because of the anti-communist and anti-labor stance of the Nazis, a Nazi plans to survive military defeat, to continue to exist politically and economically, and to recapitulate their policies at some point in the future were realized to a staggering extent. I would also point out that one of the Nazi contingency plans for surviving military defeat was to break up the Nazi party and the Nazi government into cells, to move abroad, and to use Spain as its primary base of operations. Later, during an attempted Nazi coup in 1953 led by former Goebbels aide Werner Naumann, it was revealed that, in fact, the political structure of Germany was being run through a system of cellular mafia-like control known as a Führungsring, and that, in effect, the Nazi party in exile in Madrid, Spain, the very one that had been envisioned by the Nazis prior to their defeat in 1945, just such an organization not only was formed, but it functioned in the manner it was destined to, and wielded a tremendous amount of influence in early Germany, and the point being that even though a political mythology has been adopted as truth by American political culture and Western political culture, unfortunately, that premise will not stand up under scrutiny. I refer listeners in particular to the September 13th, September 20th, September 27th, October 4th installments of Radio Free America program number 37. Beyond that, the quote new unquote Germany, in reality simply an underground extension of the Reich, has managed to achieve a very real, albeit so far limited, victory over the United States after its formal military defeat in World War II. Not a military defeat, but a political and economic defeat. Again, I realize that will sound like pure unadulterated nonsense to the uninitiated listener. Please get a hold of the archive shows, including the aforementioned Radio Free America 37, because there is simply no way that I can present the supplemental discussion in adequate fashion under the circumstances. I would remind listeners that one of the aspects of intellectual history that should be understood is that there are periods of time when things are taken for granted, and there are periods of time in which certain principles are accepted as intellectual truth, and yet those principles eventually can be disproven and utterly discredited. I would note that centuries ago it was taken as axiomatic that the sun and the moon and the stars revolved around the earth on perfect circular orbits or spherical orbits. I also would remind listeners that it was taken for granted that the sun revolved around the earth. Both, of course, were disproved long ago. Just such a comparison could be made with the contemporary political mythology which has it that Germany was denazified. Not so, but because it was deemed necessary in the West during the Cold War to portray the Federal Republic of Germany, what used to be West Germany, as contrasting with the Stalinist dictatorship in East Germany, it was deemed necessary to deem Germany, to characterize Germany as being denazified. There was a relatively thin veneer of democracy, but the core institutions of the Federal Republic were the same as those of the Third Reich. So I refer interested listeners to Radio Free America 37, also the first two Radio Free America shows. Indicative of the prevailing viewpoint concerning Germany are some well-meaning, though not overly perceptive, statements made by filmmaker Steven Spielberg this past week. His hit film, Schindler's List, about the Holocaust opened in Germany this past week, and an account of Spielberg's observations was carried in the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, March 2nd of 1994. This is a Reuters story, dateline of Frankfurt, Germany, and headlined, Schindler's List opens in Germany, subheaded, Spielberg says Holocaust film isn't meant as a reminder of guilt. It reads in part, the Holocaust film Schindler's List got its German premiere yesterday. U.S. director-producer Steven Spielberg, many of whose relatives were killed in the Holocaust, said at the opening that his film is not meant as a reminder of guilt for today's Germans. Quote, I would feel it is time in Germany for this generation to teach their children without showing guilt and knowing that education is the way to stop another Holocaust happening. Unquote. He also said today's small, violent neo-Nazi fringe should not be seen as representing Germans as a whole or even as real Nazis. Well, of course, as we have seen in the past, the actions of the German government, the actions of Nazi institutions dating all the way back to the Third Reich and the SS, such as the Betriebene groups, the political and national security establishments of Germany, the German core companies, both industrial and financial, are acting in concert with the various Nazi parties of Germany in order to pursue policies, in particular policies with regard to its neighbors, that are very similar to those advocated by Adolf Hitler, such as the Drang nach Osten, the drive to the east. I would also note that we are seeing a similar collaboration with regard to domestic policy as well. The violent incidents by so-called neo-Nazis or skinheads are being effectively covered up by the authorities in Germany. I would note Spielberg's remarks here. Unfortunately, I would say that the viewpoint expressed by Schindler is probably a very common one in this country, and it is also demonstrably and tragically wrong. Continuing down into the article, we find Hollywood tried to film the story in the early 1960s, attracting the attention of the West German consul in Los Angeles and of Karl Carstens, C-A-R-S-T-E-N-S, then Secretary of State of the Foreign Ministry and later West German President. Rundschau quoted a message Carstens sent to regional authorities in 1965 that showed less concern for justice than for the image of West Germany. That's the Frankfurter Rundschau, a major German newspaper. Schindler was due to visit the United States, and Carstens wrote that, quote, there may be public criticism that Mr. Schindler has not been honored and that his rights to compensation, always assuming they exist, have not yet been satisfied, unquote. The film was not made, but within 2 years, Schindler began receiving a pension of 500 marks a month. In 1966, he received West Germany's Federal Service Cross in recognition of his actions. I would note that even in this particular passage that I just read to you, we can see that the cooperative pattern of action between the residual Nazi elements in Germany and the major institutions of the new, quote, new, unquote, Germany, in this case, the German political structure, that unity of action is manifest even in this passage that we are seeing here. What we're looking at is a classic example of what the Germans characterize, call Verharmlosung, or rendering harmless. Something which was viewed as threatening to the image of West Germany was covered up, in effect. Hollywood did not wind up filming the story of Schindler back in the 1960s, the early 60s, and Germany began to backtrack and to take steps which would make their treatment of Mr. Schindler look a lot better. So note again the viewpoint expressed here by Steven Spielberg. It's a common one. It is a very wrong one, wrong in terms of factually incorrect. And I think under the circumstances, Spielberg could be named as the recipient of the first annual Dave Emery You Can't Win Them All Award. Good filmmaker, bad political scientist and historian. We're going to take a musical break now, and when we come back, we're going to swing over to this side of the Atlantic, and we're going to be taking a look at some things that have taken place in the United States. We're also going to take a look at some things that have been going on in the Mediterranean area as well. Again, this broadcast, the focus of this program is explicitly anti-fascist. The type of work that I do is often demeaned as, quote, conspiracy theory, unquote. I don't think that's a very accurate term. The type of research that I do, I characterize as anti-fascist, and I think that's an accurate description. We're going to be coming back, and we're going to be taking a look at some of the political antecedents and historical antecedents of elements that are in the forefront of expressing bitter and inflammatory rhetoric over the situation in the Middle East, and also over the racial and religious situations here in the United States. We're going to be taking a look at some of the roots of third-position fascism, and we're going to be taking a look at a very important aspect of fascism, namely how its political and ideological mystification of certain issues permits it to draw upon some rather diverse resources, including resources that one would expect from a common-sense standpoint to be opposed to fascism. That coming up. I guess you could term the latter part of tonight's broadcast Strange Bedfellows, because Strange Bedfellows is what we're going to be talking about. But we're going to be talking about it after a musical break here on One Step Beyond. The next section of tonight's program, for lack of a better term, might be termed Strange Bedfellows. And we're going to be taking a look at some aspects of fascism which might seem a little bit far afield to some listeners. So we're going to be talking about some things which might at first glance appear to be irrelevant or having taken place a long time ago. We're going to be taking a look, though, at how the intellectual and ideological manipulation, which has produced some very strange bedfellows for fascism in the past, is not only operating today, but how it is affecting aspects of our contemporary political environment. When I say our, I mean not only those of us here in the United States, but people elsewhere as well. In many ways, the theme for tonight's program was cued for me by, or inspired, I guess would be a better word, by a curious juxtaposition, perhaps a deliberate one, I do not know, a curious juxtaposition of very inflammatory rhetoric in the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, February 28th, of 1984. There are two stories that are continued from the front page. The first story that I'm going to read you from is termed Mosque Killer Hailed as Hero at His Funeral. This is an article by David Hoffman, H-O-F-F-M-A-N, of the Washington Post, and it is subheaded Little Pity, Much Hate for Arab Victims of Attack. It's dateline Kiryat Arba, A-R-B-A, Israeli Occupied West Bank. And on page A11 of to the San Francisco Chronicle for 2/28/94, we find the following account of some of the eulogies that were delivered for Dr. Baruch Goldstein, the individual who massacred a number of Arabs in a mosque a short time ago. And that massacre has not only sparked widespread disturbances in the Israeli-occupied territories, but also it certainly threatens at this point the Middle East peace process. Reading from the Chronicle of 2/28/94, again on page A11, the third column from the right. Many in the crowd here openly supported the massacre. Quote, Baruch Goldstein was the greatest Jew alive, not in one way, but in every way, said Shmuel HaKohen, 34, a teacher at a Jerusalem college who was a friend of Goldstein. The man's name, capital S-H-M-U-E-L, last name, capital H-A-C-O-H-E-N. Continuing. Milling in a crowd of religious Jews and soldiers who gathered here, HaKohen, who was also an immigrant from the United States and a Kahane follower, added, quote, The worst thing is that in the last year, so many Jews have been knifed and slaughtered and shot. These, quote, innocent people, unquote, you talk about in the so-called mosque. This is the burial place of all our forefathers, and they go there and sing death to the Jews. Is that innocent people? I think it was necessary, he said, of the massacre, and it's necessary to kill a lot more. There are no innocent Arabs here. And thank God that one Jewish hero reminded us that it had almost become legal to kill Jews in the street. He is the only one I know who could do it, the only one who was 100% perfect. Certainly some very inflammatory rhetoric, though not surprising given the individual's political pedigree. This Shmuel HaKohen is also a follower of the late militant far right-wing Israeli rabbi, Rabbi Meir Kahane, assassinated by a fellow named Nasser, whose Islamic milieu in the United States is inextricably linked with the fortunes of and the activities of Sheikh Rahman. And Sheikh Rahman, of course, has some well-documented connections with our own national security establishment. Note that the investigation into the assassination of Kahane was limited because, according to one FBI informant, because of the U.S. national security establishment's and intelligence agency's sponsorship of Sheikh Rahman in the United States. That has been effectively covered up the connections between Sheikh Rahman and elements of our own intelligence system, the so-called Afghan connection, one of the many X factors looming in the background not only of the World Trade Center bombing, the verdict in which was handed in this past week, but also of an upcoming trial of Sheikh Rahman and some associates for allegedly plotting to blow up landmark and commuter tunnels and to commit political assassinations in New York City. One wonders, perhaps, how deep some of the streams of intrigue run, some of the waters of intrigue run, given the recurrence of elements associated with Meir Kahane on the one side, and elements associated with Middle Eastern terrorism, Sheikh Rahman, and through Sheikh Rahman, elements of our own national security establishment. But one, there need not be a hard operational intelligence link between the Kahane organization and any other institution to warrant, I think, some discussion of the political forebears of the Israeli right wing, and that, of course, elements of that right wing have been very supportive of the settlements that have led to the sorts of confrontations that we're seeing in the Middle East, both assassinations of some of those Jewish settlers as well as these sorts of activities that Baruch Goldstein engaged in, his massacre of people who were praying in the mosque. The activities of the type that Baruch Goldstein engaged in, of course, directly threaten the Middle East peace process at this point. And I would note the inflammatory nature of the rhetoric, indicative of the sorts of sentiments that drive elements of the Israeli right wing. The Israeli right wing at this point could be viewed properly as being the heirs to an element of the Zionist movement which could be and which was explicitly fascist and which might be seen as having a considerable ideological proximity to fascism even today. I note again the nature of this rhetoric. We're going to go into some of the political history of the Israeli right wing, and specifically we're going to take a look at elements of the Zionist movement that were explicitly fascist a little later in the program. But note the rhetoric here. It is very similar to rhetoric that we're going to see coming from a very different source, and just two columns over on the same page of the same newspaper on the same day. Again, quoting Shmuel HaKohen, The worst thing is that in the last year, so many Jews have been killed and slaughtered and shot. These innocent people you talk about in the so-called mosque. Well, it wasn't a so-called mosque, it was a mosque. That kind of rhetoric, though, is very similar to rhetoric that we see just two columns over. In the right-hand column on page A11 of the Chronicle for 2/28/94, there's a continuation of a Chronicle Wire Services story also from the front page, and right under the first part of the article I just read you, or from which I just read to you. This particular article is Dateline Chicago headline, Farrakhan and former aide renew attacks against whites and Jews. As we looked at in the miscellaneous two-part archive show dealing with the fascist third position, the aforementioned Louis Farrakhan is one of the heroes, along with such people as Mao, Hitler, Muammar Gaddafi, and Ayatollah Khomeini, of the fascist third position, an element of the international fascist movement which is closely allied with extreme left-wing terrorists in Europe and as well as Middle East, some of the more reactionary elements of Middle Eastern fundamentalist groups. And the links between Middle Eastern terrorism, elements of the fascist third position, and elements of our own national security establishment are well documented. Not that our national security establishment as a whole is linked to them, but certainly people like Oliver North have worked in the past with people like Manzer al-Qassar, very closely connected with Abu Abbas, people like Otfried Hepp, a German neo-Nazi of the Sportgruppe Hoffmann, individuals who are major players on the landscape of the fascist third position. I would also note that there has been historical cooperation between the Farrakhan organization and elements of American neo-fascism. American neo-fascists such as Robert Miles and Tom Metzger have worked in the past with the Farrakhan organization, as we looked at in Radio Free America 13. Beyond that, as we will see later on in the program, there is a pattern of historical cooperation between the Nation of Islam under Elijah Muhammad and American Nazi elements. Skipping down into this particular article about the rapprochement between Farrakhan and his aide Khalid Mohammed, or at least the public growing together of these two individuals following a period of relative estrangement. There is a speech that Mohammed made to a black women's group in Baltimore that is as ripe in its anti-Semitism as the speech of Shmuel HaKohen was, or is, in its anti-Arab racism. Quoting Khalid Mohammed, just two columns over from that very ripe piece of rhetoric from Shmuel HaKohen, we find, quote, "I say you're called Goldstein, Silverstein, and Rubenstein because you've been stealing all the gold and silver and rubies all over the world. And it's true because of your stealing and roguing and lying all over the face of the earth," unquote, Mohammed declared. Elsewhere in the speech, he referred to Jews as, quote, "the bloodsuckers of the poor," unquote, adding, again quoting, "It's that old no-good Jew, that old imposter Jew, that old hook-nosed, bagel-eating, lox-eating, Johnny-come-lately perpetrating a fraud, just crawled out of the caves and hills of Europe, so-called damn Jew," unquote. Note the use of the term so-called damn Jew. Reminds me a little bit of the rhetoric of Shmuel HaKohen, the so-called mosque. Interesting. I think perhaps listeners can begin to understand the theme of tonight's program, Strange Bedfellows. These two individuals, the militant Israeli settler, the right-wing Israeli, and the militant black American Muslim, although their rhetoric is directed at the camps of each other to a certain extent, at the same time, I think the type of rhetoric is almost identical. And beyond that, as we will see, the mindset behind this type of rhetoric is, in fact, identical. And we will see that there is not nearly as much political real estate between a Shmuel HaKohen and a Khalid Mohammed as people might be led to suspect. Continuing in this article about Khalid Mohammed, after his use of the term so-called damn Jew, after all of these other adjectives, again, reminiscent to me of the, to my way of thinking, of the rhetoric of Shmuel HaKohen, Khalid Mohammed continues, to cheers and applause, he said he would not apologize for his keen college speech. Quote, "I will never apologize to this bastard, never," unquote, he said, again quoting, "I want to see my enemy on his back, whining, crying, on his back, begging for mercy. No mercy here. If you give the cracker mercy and you turn your back, he will take you out. Don't give the cracker no mercy. Never will I say I am not an anti-Semite. Whatever he is, goddammit, I'm against him. I pray for my enemy all the time. I pray that God will kill my enemy and take him off the face of the planet Earth," unquote. Rhetoric that some of which at least would have made Joseph Goebbels blush, but is obviously very reminiscent of the sorts of things that came out of the mouth of Hitler's propaganda minister. What we're going to be looking at this evening is an aspect of fascism which has permitted both elements of the type that one sees manifested in the Kahane organization and people like Shmuel HaKohen, and the sort of rhetoric that he used to eulogize the mass murderer, Baruch Goldstein, and also the forces that have manifested themselves as the Nation of Islam, and Khalid Mohammed and Louis Farrakhan. Both the Shmuel HaKohens and the Meir Kahanes on the one hand, and also the Louis Farrakhans and the Khalid Mohammeds, have been able to find operational connections and, to a certain extent, some ideological affiliations, or perhaps from a better standpoint, perceived ideological affiliations with the forces of fascism than one might suppose on first glance. Now, I want to point out that there is no historical relationship that I am aware of, or a direct, I should say, historical relationship between the Kahane organization and its affiliates and some of the explicitly fascist elements of the Zionist movement that we're going to look at in a short period of time. However, the Kahane organization and its allied forces in Israel could be very accurately said to be the ideological and political successors to such institutions as the Beit Harim and the Stern Gang that we'll be talking about a little later. Again, elements of the Zionist movement that were explicitly fascist, or that were willing to ally with the forces of fascism to achieve political goals. I would note that elements of the Nation of Islam, as I've said, as I said a short period of time ago, and as we looked at in Radio Free America 13, have worked with Aryan Nations elements in the recent past. I would also note that even under Elijah Muhammad, I can't say the founder, he wasn't actually the founder, but the leading figure in the history the most significant figure in the history of the Nation of Islam, both Elijah Muhammad's Nation of Islam as well as Louis Farrakhan's Nation of Islam have actually been able to forge working links with American neo-fascists. The Muhammad Organization worked with, among others, George Lincoln Rockwell and his American Nazi Party, and indeed, even Marcus Garvey's organization was able to find some political common ground or perceived political common ground with such disparate organizations, with organizations that would appear to be completely opposed to an organization like Marcus Garvey's, namely the Ku Klux Klan. We're going to be taking a look, too, at Marcus Garvey's stated affinity for certain aspects of fascism. I think a statement which could be viewed as being more methodological in nature rather than ideological, because the organization, as we shall see, of Marcus Garvey was not of the explicitly corporatist outlook that true fascism espouses of necessity. However, because in the first place, fascism has engaged in ideological mystification, which has permitted the operational synthesis of seemingly opposed elements, and beyond that, because of the practical use of anti-colonial movements by the fascist powers of World War II, there have been alliances formed in the past, and there are alliances operating in the present that are, on the one hand, very surprising and also very important to understand. We're going to begin this discussion this evening by taking a look, I think before we get into some of the historical aspects of tonight's discussion, I would note that the mindset that we're looking at both on the part of the Shmuel HaKohens and also on the part of people who think as Khalid Muhammad did, there has been violent activity on the part of the Nation of Islam toward Jewish people that I'm aware of. The rhetoric, the violence has been strictly rhetorical. However, there are some disturbing signs that that rhetorical violence may be gaining in popularity and that the ideological elements associated with it may be on the upswing. Certainly, this past week, we have seen violence echoed across the Atlantic Ocean and a grim echo of the bloodshed that was the blood that was shed by Baruch Goldstein was played out in New York this past week. And no doubt people are aware of the shooting of a number of Hasidic Jews as they rode across a bridge in New York City. Reading now from the San Jose Mercury News of Friday, March 4th of 1994, an article by Jerry Hester of the New York Daily News. This is Dateline New York. And headline, New York suspect probed for ties to drug ring. Police suspect a conspiracy and attack on Jews. A number of aspects of this article have been roundly denied by authorities. I do think it's worth offering up in this context, though, because under certain circumstances, denials are pro forma. The article reads in part, investigators are looking into whether the suspect in the shooting of four Jewish students on the Brooklyn Bridge is a heroin smuggler linked with a Lebanese drug ring whose members may have connections to Hezbollah, sources said. Top law enforcement sources said Thursday that the name of Rashad Baz, B-A-Z, a Lebanese national, had emerged in the past 18 months in an investigation by New York authorities of an international drug ring. Investigators found a, quote, vague reference, unquote, to Hezbollah, the Islamic fundamentalist group linked to dozens of terrorist acts. Lebanon is believed to be a key transaction point in the operation, the sources said. Meanwhile, police said they had formed a task force to investigate whether there was a shooting, whether there was a conspiracy in Tuesday's shooting of the four Hasidic students. And ABC News reported Thursday that Baz, a cab driver, and the two men accused of helping him ditch evidence were members of a Brooklyn-based militant Arab group under watch by the FBI's counterterrorist task force and Mossad, the Israeli spy agency. The cache of weapons recovered from Baz's home was earmarked for use in future terrorist attacks, the ABC report alleged.